Good evening, all. Welcome to Behind the News for March 15, 2006. This is 2007. I'm sorry about that. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments up for tonight. First, unusual thing. I'm going to reprise a talk I gave at the Left Forum this past weekend on just who makes up the American ruling class these days. And then at the bottom of the hour, an interview recorded yesterday with the British anarchist Ian Bone, who is the author of a new book, Bash the Rich. I got to say, this is perhaps the funniest interview I've ever done, but it's also very, very interesting, thoughtful, great, even inspiring. So before we get to all that, some words on the economic scene. Our neighbors on Wall Street had quite a day of it last Tuesday. Actually, our studio is on Wall Street, but most of the finance business has moved to Midtown. But as a place of imaginative geography, nothing can replace Wall Street. And speaking of Wall Street, a little plug. Verso allowed my 1996 book of that title, updated in 1997, which explains everything you'd ever want to know about finance and then some, they let it go out of print, so the rights reverted to me. The book is now available for free download as an Acrobat file on the web at wallstreetthebook.com. That's all one word, wallstreetthebook.com. Back to our figurative neighbors, the financiers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, the most popular measure of the U.S. stock market, was down almost 250 points on Tuesday, and then fell about another 100 points on Wednesday morning before recovering and closing up on the day. It spent most of today meandering sideways, although I haven't checked how it closed. But as I often say on this show, a lot of the ups and downs of the market mean nothing to those who aren't intimately involved, but sometimes they do have causes and or effects in the real world. The turmoil on Tuesday and Wednesday was the result of two real-world events, a weaker-than-expected report from the Census Bureau on retail sales in the month of February, and more trouble in the subprime mortgage market. Retail sales are a very large part of the U.S. economy, so any slowdown in that area could mean trouble for the broad economy, including employment and income for you and me. The rate of retail sales growth has roughly halved over the last year. This slowing trend may be a reflection of deteriorating personal finances or growing anxiety about the economy, causing people to be more cautious about their spending, or both. And the subprime implosion, which I mentioned when I was last here a couple of weeks ago, has been gathering force. Subprime is the industry name for the sector of the mortgage market populated by poorer people or those with spotty credit histories. As the housing bubble inflated from 2001 through 2006, bankers got more and more aggressive about lending money. Prospective borrowers often didn't have to prove their incomes. The bankers just took their word for it. And surprise, surprise, a lot of people lied about them. And to make the payments more affordable, the mortgage industry developed a lot of creative products, as they say, like adjustable rate loans with very low introductory payments that would rise, often sharply, over time. Either the borrowers didn't understand what they were agreeing to, or they had just hoped that house prices would rise enough that they could sell at a profit or refinance later on. But in any case, a lot of these subprime loans have started to go sour as the housing market has stalled. And this is in a relatively good economy, with the unemployment rate at the low end of its historical range and interest rates up only slightly from generation lows. Several subprime lenders have reported serious trouble, and a few have now gone under. Hearing that, the institutions that fund those lenders, like bigger banks, have cut off the sector. Thus, the whole subprime system, about 10% of the total housing market, has pretty much seized up over the last few weeks. This is bad news for borrowers. It's going to be harder for all but the most solvent among us to get a mortgage, at least until everyone forgets about this spot of trouble, a year or two or three from now. And a lot of existing borrowers may lose their houses. The Mortgage Bankers Association reported the other day that a record number of foreclosures were initiated at the end of last year, though to be fair, that's only about 0.5% of the total mortgage market that's now in foreclosure. The number of people delinquent, the number percentage of loans that's actually delinquent or running behind is rising, but still below peak levels we've seen in earlier troubled periods. But those are usually formal recessions. So for this to be happening in what's supposed to be the good phase of the business cycle is pretty unusual and more than a little scary. But the bigger risk is that this subprime trouble will spread beyond that sector to the much larger middle and upper income market, and it could lead to a generalized credit crunch as panicked lenders stop making loans. If that happens, the economy could stop dead in its tracks. Since housing has been directly or indirectly responsible for about half the growth in incomes and employment over the last several years, that could tip us into a recession, and perhaps a serious one. Wall Street, which had been remarkably complacent in recent years, is now acting panicky, and if the folks at the top of the heap start getting stingy, then the middle and bottom of the heap could be in for some serious trouble. Okay, let's take a little musical break and listen to this from World Burns to Death. And that, an excerpt from Boiling Blood by the band World Burns to Death, or I should say Boiling Blood by World Burns to Death. They're an Austin-based punk band with a new album called Totalitarian Sodomy. I think it's only available on vinyl. I had to digitize that from vinyl, but really good stuff. And it's amazing, people making really hot punk rock after all these years. And now let's turn to a reprise, a radio reprise of a talk I gave this past weekend at the Left Forum, held here at Cooper Union, just a few blocks north of here, at a panel sponsored by the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation. It was called the panel was called "The Power of Money and the Money of Power," and my talk is based on early research I'm doing for a my next book project, which is tentatively called Take Me to Your Leader, a study of who exactly is the American ruling class these days. So this is me, Doug Henwood, in a talk, a version of a talk I gave a few days ago.
I'm in the early stages of a book on the American ruling class, so indulge me some fragmentary thoughts on this topic today. I welcome any comments that might clarify my thinking. I started thinking about this issue, who exactly constitutes the American ruling class today, and is there even such an entity in any kind of coherent sense, in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. And now that Iraq has turned out to be such a disaster, with only a small circle of Bush loyalists and Christopher Hitchens claiming otherwise, the question gains even more salience. Why did the U.S. invade Iraq? Was the oil industry jonesing for its reserves? An oil industry told me on this program that they didn't push for such an invasion, but maybe he was lying. Was Cheney imagining an endless, lush banquet of contracts for Halliburton? They've certainly gotten those. But are such large-scale decisions really made on such parochial grounds? Was there some elite consensus that it served the long-term strategic interests of the U.S.? If that's true, why did that become suddenly more urgent in 2003? And if so, where did they meet to make the decision? Wasn't killing a million Iraqis through sanctions good enough anymore? Why was it worth disregarding the risks of an invasion that were quite accurately forecast by any number of people who knew something about Iraq? And why, once it became clear that things were not going well, didn't the grown-ups step in and push hard for a Kerry victory in 2004? Do such grown-ups even exist? So who is running the show today in the United States? In the 1983 edition of Who Rules America, William Domhoff argued that the upper-class WASPs listed in the Social Register were the core of the American ruling class, meritocratically augmented with the cream of the corporate crop. C. Wright Mills, writing almost 30 years earlier, pretty much agreed. This peak status was earned through their ownership of corporate stock and exercised through their domination of elite think tanks through board connections and the political process through campaign contributions. Certainly there's a lot about this that's still true. Politicians would be lost without the professionals who think for them and broke without a continuing stream of checks from the various personifications of capital. But that WASP ruling class now looks dissipated, and not just in their personal habits. Its fortune has been sliced into too many parts over the generations to be meaningful in a U.S. stock market now capitalized at nearly $12 trillion. The Social Register is a shell of its former self. It's now published by a fairly nouveau outfit, Forbes. Other institutional expressions of Domhoff's ruling class are in better shape. The Council on Foreign Relations is thriving. With an imposing headquarters in Manhattan's Park Avenue, it has $205 million in assets and just $9 million in liabilities. But its deliberative style is out of fashion in the Bush years. It could reclaim its prominent role someday, a prospect made more likely by the need to find a non-embarrassing exit from Iraq, but not yet. Which returns me to the question, with the WASP elite having faded since the 1970s, what has been taking its place? Certainly, as has long been pointed out, the old Northeastern WASP crowd has been supplanted by forces from the South and West, who are, at least on the surface, sometimes hostile to their elders. George W. Bush, himself from high-end Yankee stock, nonetheless keeps his distance from Yale to boost his Texas credentials. His father's handlers made it known that that president loved to snack on pork rinds, an incredible piece of public relations designed to convince voters that he was a man of the people, but it never really worked. His son, who pronounces insurance with the accent on the first syllable and vehicle with the accent on the second, seems to need no such PR, though it's hard to believe he learned these habits at Andover, Yale, or Harvard. You'd never know that he bought his Crawford Ranch, where his main preoccupations are clearing brush and torturing the White House press corps, in 1999, just a year before the stolen election on the advice of Karl Rove. Still, it's not all just symbolism. There were real interests behind Bush's rise from Texas to the national scene. In Texas, his prominent early supporters included some oil men who knew him from his failed attempts to make a living exploring for hydrocarbons in the 1980s, and Richard Rainwater, the former investment manager for the Bass Brothers, the Fort Worth-based billionaires. While governor, Bush did several favors for Rainwater and his business interests. Among his other crucial business supporters were Thomas Hicks, chair of the Hicks, Muse, Tate, and Forst buyout firm, and top executives of Enron. Now that George W. Bush is president, extractive and military industries seem to have a special place in the administration's heart. Is that our new ruling class? Texas financiers and oil men with some neocons hired to do their thinking? If so, they seem to be hitting a wall. Bush's approval ratings in the low 30s, and the Republicans got creamed in last November's election. The WASP elite used to find political expression in the pre-Reagan Republican Party, the party of Taft and Rockefeller. Now, all that's left of them are pathetic remnants like Senator Lincoln Chafee, who lost his seat last November anyway. Writers on the left often like to focus on the rightward lurch of the Democrats, but the transformation of the Republican Party has been far more profound. In the 1950s and 60s, the two parties were surprisingly similar, with liberal and conservative wings and a lot in between. Among northern electoral districts, party allegiance was less correlated with income than it is today. Yes, the Democrats have moved to the right in some ways, but no Democrat today would filibuster a civil rights bill. By contrast, as a black friend once told me, most African Americans look at a Republican and see a Klansman's bedsheet. But over the last couple of decades, the Republican Party has transformed itself into one of the most right-wing mainstream parties in the world, with a base now in the South and West. This reflected the revival of the right beginning in the mid-1950s after the losses of the 1930s and 1940s. Of course, some business interests, especially the smaller ones, never accepted the New Deal, but Wall Street and the Fortune 500 had largely made peace with it. Not a happy peace, but they'd come to live with it. The rebellion against this compromise was initially confined to a very marginalized right, consisting of a subset of the petty bourgeoisie and a new crop of conservative intellectuals gathered around William Buckley's National Review, founded in 1955. The movement gathered strength with Barry Goldwater's 1964 presidential campaign, which was an electoral disaster, but a symbol of the rising strength of the right within the Republican Party. As the 1970s progressed, however, the right gained strength. As Thomas Ferguson and Joel Rogers demonstrate in Right Turn, while the public had moved right on some issues, like crime and welfare, there was certainly no mandate for the sort of ruling class offensive ultimately mounted by Reagan when he took office in 1981. The driving force for this was the rightward move within the corporate elite, which was distressed by the collapse in corporate profitability from the golden age highs into the 1970s doldrums, and a general erosion of bourgeois authority that took economic form as rising inflation and bear markets in stocks and bonds, and political form in wildcat strikes, sabotage on the line, and third world demands for a new redistributionist global economic order. An important part of that class war was conducted by the Republican Party and Reagan, an old corporate tool of General Electric, one of the few big companies that was actively fighting the New Deal in the 1950s. and they were supplemented by a posse of Southern California businessmen. The Reagan Democrats who voted Republican in 1980, as some kind of phantasmic assertion of race privilege and masculine toughness, didn't expect the deep recession of 1981-82 and the union-busting agenda initiated by the mass firing of the striking air traffic controllers, but they got that anyway. That agenda was greatly aided by the high interest rate policies initiated by Paul Volcker, who took over at the Federal Reserve in 1979 with the announcement that the American standard of living had to decline. Volcker was appointed by Carter, so there was some bipartisan aspects to the late 1970s, early 1980s crackdown. But it's highly unlikely that a Democratic president in the 1980s would have broken a union, lowered taxes on the rich so deeply, or cut domestic spending as deeply as Reagan. But it wasn't just the state. There were many changes in the financial markets of the 1980s that greatly transformed class relations. This transformation has its root in the 1970s. A milestone was Wall Street's May Day, the May 1, 1975 deregulation of commissions, which had been previously set, but now were open to competition. That formal change helped usher in a new regime on Wall Street. The relationship gave way to the transaction. The pre-May Day Wall Street was dominated by connections. Industrial firms always dealt with the same banker, and bankers were recruited on the basis of prep school ties and other social connections. Fixed commissions stabilized those arrangements as price competition was kept in check. The demise of fixed commissions, however, introduced competition into Wall Street's previously clubby world. Competition, ever the revolutionary principle of capitalism, transformed the business scene. The old model that John Kenneth Galbraith described in The New Industrial State, of a largely vestigial shareholding class, passively assenting while professional managers ran businesses while aspiring mainly to a regime of secure mediocrity, that had given way to a far more intense and demanding regime of profit maximization. By the end of the 70s, vestigial stockholders of liberal myth-making were up in arms, having lost all patience with their managers' complacent mediocrity. With the 1980s came an unleashing of the leveraging mania and the declaration of a new era of shareholder rights. For much of the decade, what Alan Greenspan once called unaffiliated corporate restructurers launched attacks on established corporations that were deemed insufficiently profitable. Using billions in borrowed money, individuals like Carl Icahn and partnerships like Kohlberg, Kravis, Roberts either bought stakes in firms with sagging stock prices or took entire companies private. Faced with outside pressure from purely financial interests to maximize profits, firms cut costs by downsizing and outsourcing. They sold or shut unprofitable divisions and in general just smashed the old Galbraith paradigm. The maneuvers involved lots of debt, typically, which promoters described as a great incentive to slash spending and sell off underperforming assets, but it left corporate America in a weakened state when the boom ended in 1989. Wall Street continued to shake up what it calls the real sector in the 1990s by switching from debt to shareholder activism. They were led in this by public pension funds like the California Public Employees Retirement System, known as CalPERS, which made up hit lists of underperforming corporations and pressed them to get their act together. Though the approach was different from that of the 1980s, the expectations were the same. Cut costs, raise profits, and get the stock price up. To press the point, top managers were increasingly paid in stock options rather than direct salaries in order to get them to think and act like shareholders. The latest development on Wall Street has been the emergence over the last several years of hedge funds and private equity. The first are pools of speculative capital that move in and out of investments with often lightning speed. And the second are pools of longer-term capital that buy up whole companies and slim them down in the interest of making them more profitable. Maybe these new forms will prove economically unsustainable, requiring too much debt and/or generating too much instability. Or maybe they will prove to be an important new mode of organizing economic and ultimately political power. But at least public companies are subject to stiff regulations about disclosure, not, of course, that they're always enthusiastic about or honest about complying. But filings with the SEC often provide considerable information about finances, business relationships, executive salaries, and pending litigation. And the public corporate forum offers a means for activist shareholders to influence corporate policy. Sadly, such activists can include both greedheads seeking even greater commitment to profit maximization, as well as orders of nuns seeking greater commitment to peace and social justice. But the private corporate forum is, in part, about doing the work of the greedheads and out of public view. So the real change would be that the nuns wouldn't have the access they do with a public company. Yes, the nuns usually lose, but at least they can raise the issue. Instead, it looks like we're moving towards what we might call the further privatization of the private sector. but where nuns can no longer tread, corporate environmentalists can rush in. You may have heard of the proposed takeover of the Texas electric utility TXU by two big private equity groups, Kohlberg Kravis Roberts and Texas Pacific. And by the way, it's funny how companies are all becoming their stock symbols these days, like TXU, just like cities are becoming their airport codes, LAX and PDX. Anticipating trouble from environmentalists, the former head of Bush Senior's EPA, William Riley, who now works for Texas Pacific, called in the most corporate-friendly environmental group of them all, Environmental Defense, to smooth the deal. ED, that's Environmental Defense, not erectile dysfunction, persuaded the principals to cut back TXU's plan to build 11 new coal-fired power plants and build only three. While this may sound like a victory of sorts, some TXU board members and shareholders were alarmed by the expense of building nearly a dozen new plants, so there was talk within the company of cutting back to just five or six new plants anyway. But you have to wonder what an environmental group is doing giving its imprimatur to building even one new coal-fired plant when they should be pushing instead for conservation and new forms of energy generation. Since politics is all about compromise, why enter the game so deeply compromised from the start? But is it right that NGOs and private equity groups should be making environmental policy? I'm in the early stages of trying to figure out just what the emergence of these hedge funds and private equity groups means politically. Are these new configurations of power that will engage the state in fresh ways, or are they merely just another set of variations on familiar themes? I was reading through a batch of articles that my crack research assistant put together, and the headline on one struck me. The ED-TXU deal represented, quote, the privatization of politics. I thought, nice phrase, and something to think about. Then I noticed it was from the New York Sun, and it smelled a rat. And the rat-like odor deepened as I read the piece. The author, Howard Husok, of the right-wing Manhattan Institute, was distressed that there was any environmental component to the deal at all. Private environmental groups were interfering with the maximization of profit, something the state of Texas would never do. I'm guessing that were Texas run by hardcore Greens, he'd be writing op-eds denouncing the government interference in the private affairs. This is one of the occupational hazards of being a far leftist. Whenever you're distressed by the mushiness of mainstream liberals, you're reminded that there's always some far-right loon who finds even the mushiness excessive. That liberal mushiness would seem radical, and that hedge funds and private equity for now are seeing things go pretty much their own way, are proof that the three-decade-long class war from above has largely been successful. But there are some serious long-term problems. The disaster in Iraq, and the less widely noticed one in Afghanistan, the Chavez ascendancy and a broad rebellion against neoliberalism in Latin America, and a massive current account deficit in the U.S. and net foreign debt now approaching $4.5 trillion, to pick just three obvious problems. And then there's the possibly catastrophic effects of global warming, to pick a more subtle one. You'd think a serious ruling class might be worried about these things, but they're not showing public signs of anxiety. Maybe they are in their private clubs, but you'd think some of that anxiety would leak beyond those posh walls into the organs of the lumpen bourgeoisie. Why the apparent complacency? A provisional answer might be that any distinction between the business community and the ruling class has largely disappeared, and that policy is now made through a Wall Street lens of maximizing profits over the next few quarters, and the long term can take care of itself. The old WASP elite, which I certainly don't mean to romanticize since they have a lot to answer for, like the Bay of Pigs and well-done lamb, did have a contempt for commerce that allowed it to think beyond the earnings and election cycles. It had an ethic of class solidarity that looks to be lacking in today's world, when the crucial question isn't whom you room with at St. Paul's, but how many vehicles the parking garage under your Greenwich mansion can accommodate. Karl Polanyi famously argued in The Great Transformation that a society run on the principles of the self-regulating market would disintegrate because of the corrosive effects of atomistic competition on social bonds. Maybe that doesn't apply just to whole societies. It could also apply to the upper orders who've come to value that transaction over the relationship. Tax cuts and deregulation have been like psychotropic drugs for the American business class and the households who live on returns to capital. But the economic model has an unsustainable look about it. U.S. net foreign debt, virtually non-existent in 1980, has skyrocketed. The U.S. cannot keep running huge fiscal and current account deficits forever. That's not to say the U.S. is headed for some sort of major smash-up, as many leftists and some right-wingers argue, but it does mean a retrenchment, some sort of homegrown structural adjustment program that the present business community and its political system seem incapable of conceiving, much less imposing. The reaction to Social Security privatization suggests that smooth political sailing is hardly guaranteed for a belt tightening. But just maybe, the historical task of Hillary Clinton, former corporate lawyer, former Walmart director, will be to calm the waters as that austerity program is launched. And that was me, Doug Henwood, doing a special radio version of a talk I delivered at the Left Forum this past weekend at Cooper Union called Take Me to Your Leader, the American Ruling Class Today, on a panel sponsored by the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation. It's based on my early research for a book project I'm working on the American Ruling Class Today. And let's take a little break for station ID, and we'll be back to hear from Ian Bone.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say...
And we're back. This is WBAI at 99.5 FM on your radio dial, but also on the web at WBAI.org, so you can listen to us wherever you are. My name is Doug Henwood, and the show is Behind the News. Ian Bone is a British anarchist who's been involved in radical politics since the 1960s. He reached his pinnacle of fame in the 1980s when he was part of the impolite resistance to the savage reign of Margaret Thatcher. He's especially known for his association with Class War, which started as a newspaper and then became a political movement of sorts and even, on occasion, a punk band. I recorded this interview with him yesterday. You'd hardly know from listening to him that he'll turn 60 later this year. Talking with people like this always makes me feel uptight and cerebral, but such is my fate in life. While this may be the funniest of the hundreds of interviews I've done on this show, Ian Bone is also thoughtful and even inspiring. Bone is the author of a memoir, Bash the Rich, True Life Confessions of an Anarchist in the UK, published in Britain by Tangent Books and available in the US from AK Press. Ian Bone.
Welcome, Ian Bone. Anarchism is a familiar presence in the radical American left. How big is it in Britain?
Probably no bigger than it is in the States at the moment. It's, I mean, to be honest, there's very few sort of active. There's a whole range of armchair anarchists who never get out their armchairs to do anything. But in terms of out on the streets action kind of anarchists, which is the tradition which I identify with, not very many.
Did it have an experience of growth in the 80s when most of your book is about?
Yeah, it tends to go cyclical, really. There was a growth in the 60s around the time of the sort of hippie love-ins in 67 and sort of street fighting man against the Vietnam War in 68. Another sort of growth around 77, 78 with the advent of the punk movement. Again, in the 80s with Margaret Thatcher, the sort of the class struggle wing of anarchism came to the fore again. And again with the anti-globalisation movement in the 90s, another upsurge. So it seems to be something when you get a new generation of people coming through every 10 years who get interested, hang about for a bit and then give up after 2 years of getting nowhere.
You write some about your parents and their labor, socialist politics, labor as in the party. How did that influence the evolution of your own politics? Was it a positive example, a negative example, a bit of both?
I think it was a bit of both. I mean, my dad was a butler, which meant he was sort of serving rich people in country mansions all his life. I mean, mum was a housemaid. They call it in service over here, and it isn't much different to being in servitude. So the class conscious angle was coming at me from a kid all the way through. And my dad was bizarrely a socialist butler, so he was wrestling with his politics at the same time as trying to serve members of the ruling class at dinner tables. So it was quite a unique and also quite funny in some ways upbringing, but it certainly shaped my sort of analysis of class politics in the future.
You said you became an anarchist reading Punch magazine at the age of 15. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, I worked out on my own that I believed in something. I wasn't quite sure what it was. It was something which had no government, no laws, no rules, and you could do what you like, and life might be short, but it would be meaningful, and I didn't have a name for it. And I was reading an article in Punch magazine while waiting for the dentist, and there it was. There was a very sarcastic article about the British anarchist headquarters with men with beards and women with beards, come to that, and it actually put the address down at the bottom, and I gingerly wrote off and asked them to send me some literature with a covering letter saying, please don't send anyone with a large beard to my house because my dad will freak out.
Your parents came out, were associated with this kind of very organized, institutionalized politics, the Labour Party, trade unions and such. Anarchism is anything but. How do you feel? Is that, were you trying to move away from that kind of institutional ossification?
Yeah, there was. I mean, for us, it was clear that voting Labour wasn't getting anywhere, that Labour just sort of administered capitalism slightly different to the Tories. I mean, it's much the same now. Labour-Tory doesn't really make much difference. And I guess it was all products of that counterculture which came about in the 1960s. And we didn't want piecemeal reform. We wanted to overthrow the state. We wanted everything then, now, if not yesterday. So it was a much more immediate, no sense of deferred gratification. We knew what we want, and we thought we knew how to get it in the event we didn't quite achieve either.
A lot of people feel that way in their adolescence. How does it linger into your full-grown adulthood?
Yeah, no, I haven't grown up. I'm still behaving disgracefully. I mean, I'm still as passionate about anarchism. I still believe the same tactics and the same direct action confrontational approach is what will get us somewhere eventually. I've got a lot more sort of jaundiced view, I guess, of the 40 years of struggle, which are generally on the left, painted as 40 years of triumphalism and this, that, and the other, a much more jaundiced sense of having organised more fiascos than triumphant events. But I think a sense of humour, and looking back at what we did, is probably pretty absent from most leftist politics. So a sense of humour can actually help you persevere a lot longer than being totally moralistic and straight up about it.
And then there's also, you write about how the trots were the enemy. They had to get rid of them. Tell us about the trots.
Yeah, we never quite managed. They're still an irritant around. The trots, I mean, we have a particular trot organisation in Britain called the Socialist Workers Party, which takes over and fronts every possible genuine grievance that comes up. If it was a swimming pool need closing down, or a road that needed rebricking, or it was the war in Iraq, the Socialist Workers Party would be around your house saying they've always agreed with the struggle and can they lead it and you can be part of it. And they're totally parasitic, and they haven't gone away. At the moment, they're allied to the Muslim Association of Britain, which is a peculiar mix of secular socialist and Islamic fundamentalists. But at least that way, they can say they're increasing in numbers, which they have to do to keep their membership in its sort of permanent state of retarded ejaculation about the possibility of revolution.
They seem to think that the anti-war movement is their own subsidiary, don't they?
Yeah, they dominate everything. They always often run the guise of front organisations, which are easily spottable because the same figures come up again. And they have effectively disillusioned so many people in this country. One generation or another has sort of been lured into front organisations by the Socialist Workers Party, got fed up when they've seen what's happening. And there's a hierarchy there which has stayed there. I mean, the leaders of the sort of anti-war movement in Britain now are the same leaders who were leading the anti-Vietnam War movement in 1968, people like Tony Benn, Ken Loach, Vanessa Redgrave, Harry Carley, and they saddled themselves with the same leaders, with the same sterile, just marching against the war, which has no effect whatsoever, tactics. So we've lost lots of battles with them, but we aim to win in the long run.
What would you see as a more effective anti-war tactic?
Well, I think certainly in this country we should have been out on the streets blocking the roads, causing some disruptions to the workers and to government. I mean, it was a march 4 years ago when it all started with over 1 million people on it, which just marched along to hear various Trotskyist speakers, bishops and Muslim fundamentalists talking in Hyde Park, and then go home. And then they repeat the exercise every year or two. And the one they just had now, it's a law of diminishing returns. There was something like 20,000 people on. And the message at the end of the day was, this is a great triumph, now go home and build for the next one next year, and you might catch yourself on telly at the end of the day. With 1 million people on the march, we could have caused significant disruption and actually, you know, add some effective opposition to the war.
You know, let's go back to the 60s for a bit. There was a lot going on then. There was like very sort of conventional Marxist-Leninist politics, or the hippies. How did you and the anarchists fit into all that?
I think 68 was the real. I mean, I was a peace and love hippie in 1967. By the end of 1968, I was a sort of fire-breathing, petrol-bomb-throwing, full-on anarchist. And I think it was the events in Europe, really, particularly Paris, May 68, all the events around the world, including in the States, the Democratic Convention. There was stuff going on around the world, the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. I mean, it didn't make sense to be a pacifist anymore. I think tons of us were overnight converted from sort of that period around about May 1968 into being sort of direct action pro-violence anarchists. And it really did. I mean, it certainly looked as though it was happening. Certainly Paris 68 looked as though there was going to be a revolution. And it meant the revolution wasn't some old idea, you know, from Kropotkin and Bakunin, but it was possible. And I've retained that belief ever since.
Yeah, you're certainly no friend of the pacifists. You use a lot of violent rhetoric. Is that symbolic, or do you actually mean, do you want to mug the rich and blow things up?
Yeah, I think we've never been part of the blow-up tendency. We've always condemned, I mean, the blow-up tendency, whether it's the Angry Brigade in this country or various other groups around them, but have always tended to be people, middle-class radicals who got fed up trying to get, hoping that the working class might do something, so have supplanted them and decided to act on their own initiatives on their behalf. And they generally tend to be middle class and a very short shelf life. I mean, in terms of the kind of tradition we emphasise with is getting out on the street, the riot tendency with a brick in one hand and a petrol bomb in the other. In fact, John Barker, who was one of the jailed Angle Brigade, is in this country, said recently at a meeting I was at that petrol bombs are far more democratic than dynamite, and that's the tendency to which we still adhere.
I'm speaking with Ian Bone, the veteran British anarchist and author of the book Bash the Rich, just published by Tangent Books in the UK and available from AK Press in the United States.
Let's talk about Class War, which was a newspaper, a movement, a band. Tell us about the evolution of it.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it started off as a newspaper with no aspirations to be anything else. But it came out in the early 80s when, you have to put it in the context of Mrs. Thatcher in Britain, who was a very full-on class warrior just on the other side to us, and the left was just lying down and being trampled all over. And so while some sections of the working class were fighting back, either in inner-city riots or in the miners' strike and the printers' strike, and we said, yeah, it's fine to fight back, it's good to fight back, it's good to throw bricks back at them. Whereas the left used to show pictures of people beaten up by police, we used to have a series of photos called Hospitalised Copper, which shows coppers that we'd put in hospital. And it struck a chord in the 80s because people really were fighting back. Thatcher did mount an all-out war on the working class. And the other thing, Class War did it with humour, and that was a perplexing thing for many people. They couldn't work out, is Class War a comic, or is it a serious newspaper, because there's so lack of humour on the left. And by default, it turned into a political movement, because people liked the paper so much, and people started saying, oh, we formed a Class War group here, there, and everywhere. And all of a sudden, we had a fairly significant movement, which is fairly confrontational. It was never part of an organised plan. It was never organised in terms of branches. It was just spontaneous local branches. And I think from about sort of 84 right up to the poll tax riot, which really did for Thatcher, in the early 90s, we were more of the opposition than the Labour Party was.
You also have a history of the amateur musician. Tell us about your musical career.
Yeah, extremely amateurish. Well, just, I guess, taking advantage of the punk movement in 77, we formed a band by accident, and we realised it was just another way of getting ideas over, in the same way as Class War got some ideas over. First record happened to coincide with The Pope visiting Britain, so we knocked out a record called The Pope is a Dope. On the other side, funnily enough, it was about the same time that the assassination attempt on Reagan in the States, so we were stuck for something. All my lyrics always rhyme, so I think whoever had fired at Reagan had tried to use fired down dum-dum bullets, so we issued a track called Dum-Dum Bullets for a Dum-Dum Dummy about the failed Reagan assassination attempt. And we continued in a whole series of tasteless songs ever since. A little number knocked out for the royal wedding of Charles and Di called Better Dead Than Wed, which has been updated, and it's much more of a sort of sing-along and a straight-on punk band. But, yeah, just another way of getting ideas over with a sense of humour and something that people can relate to.
I found a remake of Better Dead Than Wed on the web. What's the story of that?
Yeah, we just revamped. There's a narco-punk band over called Conflict. And there was yet another royal wedding of a couple of parasites, the Earl of Wessex, and I can't even remember his missus's name there. So we just did an update of the version for that, which Conflict put on their website. And because it's about 30 years since punk in 77, there's been a whole spate of punk stuff. And as we all know, punk doesn't die over here. There's tons of people walking around with studded leather jackets with Punk's Not Dead on the back. And a lot of them hadn't heard the original version of Better Dead Than Wed, so we're happy to snap the other one up.
Yeah, your use of the word parasite reminds me, you write about how Ian Jack was fascinated by your use of language. You're not afraid of words like parasite, but also a lot of antique language. What is your thinking behind that?
We think it was important to reinvent sort of language of class struggle, so we use words like toffs, and the snooty rich and snobs and stuff like that, which goes back to sort of, if anyone's seen a comic, the Beano and the Dandy tend to have characters which talk about snobs and toffs and the posh, and we consciously use a sort of Victorian language to describe the rich. Because one of the things about Class War was that we didn't like the rich, but we didn't just hate the system, we hated them individually, and we wanted to personalise it. And Class War was just as much about spitting at someone rich you saw going down the road. It was about getting on an organised demonstration somewhere. So you wanted to personalise it, and that kind of invective, which also, again, had a sort of sense of humour to it. We organised the Bash the Rich March, and first of all, which was to march into a rich area saying, we don't like you very much. And people said, can you just do that, organise a Bash the Rich march? And we said, yeah, you can, you can. And we did it. And it sort of brought home to a whole generation of people that class politics could be personal, and it was a way of venting your frustration on the system, much more so than just struggling against an amorphous the system, capitalism or something like that.
I think a lot of American audiences don't know what a TOF is. So can you define it for them?
Yeah. A TOF is basically the landed gentry in this country, the super rich, the landed aristocracy have always controlled Britain, who still own about 85% of the land, and who generally look down on anyone, not even on new money, but certainly on people who come from lower class origins, who they still tend to treat as servants or someone they should be out blasting their shotguns off if there's no grouse or pheasants to shoot.
And while we're talking about the British class system, what about the Chavs? They've made a big splash so far it's even gotten over here. What do you think?
There's an attempt to sort of demonise. Middle-class ideas have sort of pervaded everything over here in terms of even the sort of protest movements are run by the middle classes. Everything from TV, it used to be just finance and government and corporations that the upper and middle classes used to run. Now the upper classes run everything from alternative comedy to films to music. They're all run. As soon as they open their mouths, you know, basically there's some middle-class person talking. And what they've done in the meantime is to sort of demonise the rest of the working classes, ignorant, pig-ignorant, racist, low-life scum who are basically chavs who know nothing. And anyone who's working class may have basically is categorised as chav scum. And I guess we'll be working hard to sort of use some of those chav scum words, to use them in a way that we can use the words to fight back by calling ourselves chav scum and taking the fight back to them.
I'm speaking with Ian Bone, the veteran British anarchist and author of the book Bash the Rich, just published by Tangent Books in the UK and available from AK Press in the United States.
Yeah, this is an interesting point. You say you wanted to personalize the struggle. A lot of people talk about it's the system and the people are just pawns of a little larger system, but you don't think that's the way to do politics?
No, we think it is to personalise it, and I think that was class war's great breakthrough, and that's why we got patronised by the rest of the left when we talked of jostling the rich in the streets. There's a thing that happens over here every year called the Henley Regatta, which is loads of posh people in boaters and frocks and old school ties, yachting and rowing at Henley, and it's a real gathering of the rich social calendar, and we mobilised about 500 people to go there one year. Because most people hadn't seen what the rich people look like en masse. I mean, they are truly loathsome and horrible. And when you see them with their sort of chinless wonder types in their OKRs and all that, I think we had a whole generation of people there who'd never seen the rich, really, had never seen how ghastly they are together. And people came away from there absolutely fuming. They said they can't believe there's people like that in this day and age. And, yeah, I think appeals to get rid of the system and overflow the corporations are all very well, but I think to bring it home you really need, and also to vent your own anger. You know, you can't just rant against faceless bureaucracies all the time. And it fitted in very well with my background anyway, because I do really hate them. So it was a political movement constructed on that.
You say you rejected the traditional anarchist cloak of anonymity. You wanted to get out there, use publicity, and use the press, use the media.
Yeah, we talked to the press. We thought we had our own newspaper, Class War, which sold about 15,000 copies a month, which in English anarchist terms was a hell of a lot, because the other magazines about the time were selling 500 to 1,000. It did manage to break out of the ghetto and talk to ordinary working-class people. But we thought, hey, there's other people producing papers. You know, the big circulation tabloid newspapers in Britain have circulations of 3, 4, 5 million. So when the press wanted to expose us in the papers as a gang of violent anarchists struggling to overthrow the state, I mean, most anarchists would run a mile, not speak to them or deny it. And we said, yeah, we are a gang of anarchists struggling to overthrow the state. Thanks very much. We're quite happy to do an interview. And, of course, the interviews were always how terrible we were, and we were this, that and the other. But we always found our post bags sort of full of hundreds of letters weeks later, because these newspapers had circulation of millions, and we found a way of using the stories they wrote about us to turn back on them and to use to our own benefit. And we were quite happy to raise the size of sellout or your minute, you know, working with the capitalist media, because we thought, well, that's just a recipe for failure. No, we want to get our ideas out, whether it's in capitalist newspapers, in songs like Better Dead Than Wed, or in tatty newspapers like We Can Produce, or any other means, you know, by any means necessary. Actually means by any means necessary. It don't necessarily just mean posing around with a machine gun.
How'd you earn the honor of being named the most dangerous man in Britain?
Yeah, that was fun. To my mum read it, yeah. I was living off the glory of that for a couple of days, so I had a phone call off my mum and some some homely neighbour had said, you know, your son's the most dangerous brand. He is bloody well not the most dangerous brand. I won't have you saying that. And then she showed him the story in the Sunday newspapers. And bizarrely enough, it started off as the most dangerous man in Britain, which is pretty cool, actually. But somehow in the later edition, the one my mum saw was the most evil man in Britain, which doesn't have quite the same sort of Che Guevara kudos. It smacks a bit more like a serial psycho killer or something. So, yeah, my mum had diarrhoea for 2 weeks over that. And one of the things that strikes you is that, you know, other countries, people are getting shot for being a revolutionary. In this country, you just have to worry about your mum having diarrhoea for 2 weeks.
Well, in the U.S., you get ignored. You don't even get profiled here. What about your relation with the you're involved with the miners' strike, the printers' strike, when
yeah.
I guess it's when Wapping and Murdoch was busting the printers and all.
Yeah.
Now, these were strikes run by traditional bureaucratic institutionalized unions.
Yeah.
What was their anarchist relation to these entities?
Well, we took, the unions, though, the National Union of Miners was more militant than certainly the leaders of the printers' unions were. But after a while, there was a whole rank and file came up who were fighting a different battle to the union leaders. The union leaders wanted to use the sort of the workers as a stage army to wheel on and win the fight, and also not to upset the apple cart for a future Labour government, which is always what they were thinking of. So don't do anything too naughty, just win the battle of public opinion. It was clear with Mrs. Thatcher that public opinion counted for nothing. The unions still thought they could win some sort of moralistic, get nice stories about Saltley Earth miners. Thatcher realised she only wanted to win, and that was to crush both the miners and the printers. And we worked that out fairly early on. So we said the only way to win this strike is by using violence, by blocking the roads, by using more violence than Mrs. Thatcher's prepared to use, by making it impossible to sustain the odds, because she's only got so many riot police she can pull about the country, and the mines are over. And if we can, we'll instigate the second front in the inner cities of inner city rioting, which was quite possible in Britain in 81, 82, 85. So we attacked the union leaderships. I mean, the unions just became as much as a fetter on the workers as anyone else. And the miners, for example, developed a whole rank-and-file initiative, not just of looking after their own families and raising money and food parcels, but actually of organising hit squads to go around the picket lines to launch attacks on NCB property and so on. And we linked up with them early on. And, you know, we were all quite happy. They didn't care if we weren't miners. We didn't care if they weren't anarchists. We all worked together. And a lot of the miners we met then are still pretty heavily politicised now in one form or another. Eventually we lost, but for about 3 months it was a darn close run thing in the miners' strike as to who would rule Britain, and we did lose. But I guess in 1992, when the poll tax riot happened, a lot of those old defeated miners and printers were wheeled out on that riot and the other riots around the city. So you could say we might have lost those two wars, but I think we certainly won one of the battles against Thatcher in the end.
Towards the end of the book, you write about how, to be honest, a radical has to ask the question of why there are so few revolutionaries in the world
yeah.
if we're supposedly fighting for the masses. Reflect on that for us.
Yeah, I think that's a question which radicals don't reflect on. And so many organisations, anarchists included, in this country are so sort of triumphalist about everything, you know. You get 30 people on a demonstration, it's rounded up to 3,000, and people are treated like idiots, so they can't see results of their own eyes and believe what they say. And I think that we have to say, you know, given that we obviously live in an inequitable system, and you know, I think in this country something like 4% of the people own sort of 96% of the wealth. So how come that patient propaganda explaining this to people doesn't actually come about? And I think that's because people have lots of other, you know, the rational approach of explaining to people the inequities of capitalism just don't work. People are persuaded by all sorts of other things in their life, the irrational, and they have all sorts of desires and urges which aren't compassed by political movements. So I think, you know, we look back to the old sort of Wilhelm Reich ideas. You need to politicise the betting shop, the bedroom, the hotel, this, that and the other, and you need to start from where people are, and you need to have a politics that actually relates to their daily lives. This is not what is seen as the sort of inverted commas political angle, and there are very few politicos who are happy doing that. Very few politicos who actually, you know, they go on about the working class, but they don't actually choose to live amongst them or go to the same shops or the same pubs or mix with working class people, because when push comes to shove, they're basically scared of working class people because they think they're all violent, racist, they smell, and they don't have the correct politics. And until we can do something about that, we won't get very far.
And finally, what about life in Blairist Britain? You know, the 70s, look back in the 70s, it was stultifying in a way, the welfare state and the union bureaucracies and all. But now Blair's Britain is still defined in a different kind of way, as a kind of celebration of wealth and an alliance with the United States. How do you do radical anarchist politics in what seems like a very unpromising environment?
Well, I think it has been very unpromising. And, I mean, I think loads of people are walking around in this country saying, well, the working class is defeated. And there is very little sign at the moment of organized opposition. But I think the peculiar thing about Britain at the moment, it's got a very much a feel of the mid-1980s when Thatcher was at her height and waging class war. Because what Blair's created is like a, you know, exactly what Thatcher created. You've got sort of all the big companies being sold off to private equity companies. You've got huge city bonuses in the city with people sort of with a loads of money attitude earning about £10 million in bonuses. You've got in London the sort of advent of the super rich now, not just the Russian sort of billionaires, but the real super rich and a kind of conspicuous consumptive wealth, which is actually galling to working class people. At the same time, you've got it very difficult for working class people to get on the rung of the housing ladder, affordable housing. I mean, there's nothing in London now, not any kind of house in an old council flat on a third story of a tower block for less than £250,000. So there's a feel that sort of Blair has recreated Thatcherism, and there's a lot of sort of, and public sector wages are being kept down. The bizarre thing is we're also seeing the return of the toffs, because David Cameron's been trying to market himself as ordinary bloke, but it's all come out. I mean, he went to Eton. His family owns a 35,000 acre estate in Scotland. His wife, who's just portrayed as an ordinary mill town girl, well, they didn't actually explain she owned the mill town rather than work there. So, I mean, whereas you've got sort of two dynasties over there, the Clintons and the Bushes, who look like they're going to be president for 16 years, 19 prime ministers in Britain have been to Eton College. How coincidental is that? And David Cameron would be the 20th, leaving not counting Blair, who went to his Fetties, which is basically the Eton of Scotland. So we seem to go back to sort of right back to sort of the toffs and the super rich running the show. And that, again, presents us with great opportunities to do something about that. So I'm pretty optimistic about the way things have turned out at the moment.
And that was Ian Bone, the British anarchist and author of the political memoir Bash the Rich, published by Tangent Books in the UK and available from AK Press in the US. It's really refreshing to hear someone say that it's not just the system. He wants to make it personal, too. He really hates rich people. Let's go out with a 2005 remake of Class War's 1986 classic, Better Dead Than Wed, which was released to celebrate the wedding of Prince Andrew and Sarah Ferguson, a couple of useless parasites. You can download the MP3 legally and for free from the website mortarhate.com. That's MORTARHATE.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. Till next week. Bye.
Forever, when all your rings come off, you're bad, dead, and wet.